Most sophisticated estimate comes from the psychologists William Nagy and Richard Anderson. They began with a list of 227,553 different words. Of these, 45,453 were simple roots and stems. Of the remaining 182,100 derivatives and compounds, they estimated that all but 42,080 could be understood in context by someone who knew their components. Thus, there were a total of 44,453 plus 42,080, equaling 88,533 listeme words. By sampling from this list and testing the sample, Nagy and Anderson estimated that an average American high school graduate knows 45,000 words, three times as many as Shakespeare managed to use. Actually, this is an underestimate, because proper names, numbers, foreign words, acronyms, and many common undecomposable compounds were excluded. There is no need to follow the rules of Scrabble in estimating vocabulary size. These forms are all listemes, and a person should be given credit for them. If they had been included, the average high school graduate would probably be credited with something like 60,000 words. A tetrabard, and superior students, because they read more, would probably merit a figure twice as high, an octobard. Is 60,000 words a lot or a little? It helps to think of how quickly they must have been learned. Word learning generally begins around the age of 12 months. Therefore, high school graduates who have been at it for about 17 years must have been learning an average of 10 new words a day continuously since their first birthdays, or about a new word every 90 waking minutes. Using similar techniques, we can estimate that an average 6-year-old commands about 13,000 words. Notwithstanding those dull, Dick and Jane reading primers, which were based on ridiculously lowball estimates. A bit of arithmetic shows that preliterate children who are limited to ambient speech must be lexical vacuum cleaners, inhaling a new word every 2 waking hours, day in, day out. Remember that we are talking about listemes, each involving an arbitrary pairing. Think about having to memorize a new batting average or treaty date or phone number every 90 minutes of your waking life since you took your first steps. The brain seems to be reserving an especially capacious storage space and an especially rapid transcribing mechanism for the mental dictionary. Indeed, naturalistic studies by the psychologist Susan Carey have shown that if you casually slip a new color word like olive into a conversation with a 3-year-old, the child will probably remember something about it 5 weeks later. Now think of what goes into each act of memorization. A word is the quintessential symbol. Its power comes from the fact that every member of a linguistic community uses it interchangeably in speaking and understanding. If you use a word, then as long as it is not too obscure, I can take it for granted that if I later utter it to a third party, he will understand my use of it the same way I understood yours. I do not have to try the word back on you to see how you react, or test it out on every third party and see how they react, or wait for you to use it with third parties. This sounds more obvious than it is. After all, if I observe that a bear snarls before it attacks, I cannot expect to scare a mosquito by snarling at it. If I bang a pot and the bear flees, I cannot expect the bear to bang a pot to scare hunters. Even within our species, learning a word from another person is not just a case of imitating that person's behavior. Actions are tied to particular kinds of actors and targets of the action in ways that words are not. If a girl learns to flirt by watching her older sister, she does not flirt with the sister or with their parents, but only with the kind of person that she observes to be directly affected by the sister's behavior. Words, in contrast, are a universal currency within a community. In order to learn to use a word, upon merely hearing it used by others, babies must tacitly assume that a word is not merely a person's characteristic behavior in affecting the behavior of others, but a shared bidirectional system, available to convert meaning to sound by any person when the person speaks, and sound to meaning by any person when the person listens, according to the same code. Since a word is a pure symbol, the relation between its sound and its meaning is utterly arbitrary. As Shakespeare, using a mere tenth of a percent of his written lexicon and a far tinier fraction of his mental one, put it, "What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet." Because of that arbitrariness, there is no hope that mnemonic tricks might lighten the memorization burden, at least for words that are not built out of other words. Babies should not, and apparently do not, expect cattle to mean something similar to battle, or singing to be like stinging, or coats to resemble goats. Onomatopoeia, where it is found, is of no help, because it is almost as conventional as any other word sound. In English, pigs go oink. In Japanese, they go boo-boo. Even in sign languages, the mimetic abilities of the hands are put aside and their configurations are treated as arbitrary symbols. Residues of resemblance between a sign and its referent can occasionally be discerned, but like onomatopoeia, they are so much in the eye or ear of the beholder that they are of little use in learning. In American Sign Language, the sign for tree is a motion of a hand as if it was a branch waving in the wind. In Chinese Sign Language, tree is indicated by the motion of sketching a tree trunk. The psychologist Laura Ann Petitto has a startling demonstration that the arbitrariness of the relation between a symbol and its meaning is deeply entrenched in the child's mind. Shortly before they turn two, English-speaking children learn the pronouns you and me. Often they reverse them, using you to refer to themselves. The error is forgivable. You and me are deictic pronouns, whose referent shifts with the speaker. You refers to you when I use it, but to me when you use it. So children may need some time to get that down. After all, Jessica hears her mother refer to her, Jessica, using you. Why should she not think that you means Jessica? Now, in ASL, the sign for me is a point to one's chest. The sign for you is a point to one's partner. What could be more transparent? One would expect that using you and me in ASL would be as foolproof as knowing how to point, which all babies, deaf and hearing, do before their first birthday. But for the deaf children Petitto studied, pointing is not pointing. The children use the sign of pointing to their conversational partners to mean me at exactly the age at which hearing children use the spoken sound you to mean me. The children were treating the gesture as a pure linguistic symbol. The fact that it pointed somewhere did not register as being relevant. This attitude is appropriate in learning sign languages. In ASL, the pointing hand shape is like a meaningless consonant or vowel, found as a component of many other signs like candy and ugly. There is one more reason we should stand in awe of the simple act of learning a word. The logician W.V.O. Quine asks us to imagine a linguist studying a newly discovered tribe. A rabbit scurries by, and a native shouts, "Gavagai." What does Gavagai mean? Logically speaking, it needn't be rabbit. It could refer to that particular rabbit, Flopsy, for example. It could mean any furry thing, any mammal, or any member of that species of rabbit. Say, Orctologus cuniculus, or any member of that variety of that species, say, chinchilla rabbit. It could mean scurrying rabbit, scurrying thing, rabbit plus the ground it scurries upon, or scurrying in general. It could mean footprint maker or habitat for rabbit fleas. It could mean the top half of a rabbit, or rabbit meat on the hoof, or possessor of at least one rabbit's foot. It could mean anything that is either a rabbit or a Buick. It could mean collection of undetached rabbit parts, or, lo, rabbithood again, or it rabbiteth, analogous to it raineth. The problem is the same when the child is the linguist and the parents are the natives. Somehow a baby must intuit the correct meaning of a word and avoid the mind-boggling number of logically impeccable alternatives. It is an example of a more general problem that Quine calls the scandal of induction, which applies to scientists and children alike. How can they be so successful at observing a finite set of events and making some correct generalization about all future events of that sort, rejecting an infinite number of false generalizations that are also consistent with the original observations? We all get away with induction because we are not open-minded logicians, but happily blinkered humans, innately constrained to make only certain kinds of guesses, the probably correct kinds, about how the world and its occupants work. Let's say the word-learning baby has a brain that carves the world into discrete, bounded, cohesive objects, and into the actions they undergo, and that the baby forms mental categories that lump together objects that are of the same kind. Let's also say that babies are designed to expect a language to contain words for kinds of objects and words for kinds of actions, nouns and verbs, more or less. Then the undetached rabbit parts, rabbit trod ground, intermittent rabbiting, and other accurate descriptions of the scene will, fortunately, not occur to them as possible meanings of gavagai. But could there really be a preordained harmony between the child's mind and the parents? Many thinkers, from the wooliest mystics to the sharpest logicians, united only in their assault on common sense, have claimed that the distinction between an object and an action is not in the world or even in our minds initially, but is imposed on us by our language's distinction between nouns and verbs. And if it is the word that delineates the thing and the act, it cannot be the concepts of thing and act that allow for the learning of the word. I think common sense wins this one. In an important sense, there really are things and kinds of things and actions out there in the world, and our mind is designed to find them and to label them with words. That important sense is Darwin's. It's a jungle out there, and the organism designed to make successful predictions about what is going to happen next will leave behind more babies designed just like it. Slicing space-time into objects and actions is an eminently sensible way to make predictions, given the way the world is put together. Conceiving of an extent of solid matter as a thing, that is, giving a single mentalese name to all of its parts, invites the prediction that those parts will continue to occupy some region of space and will move as a unit. And for many portions of the world, that prediction is correct. Look away, and the rabbit still exists. Lift the rabbit by the scruff of the neck, and the rabbit's foot and the rabbit ears come along for the ride. What about kinds of things or categories? Isn't it true that no two individuals are exactly alike? Yes, but they are not arbitrary collections of properties either. Things that have long furry ears and tails, like pom-poms, also tend to eat carrots, scurry into burrows, and breed like, well, rabbits. Lumping objects into categories, giving them a category label in mentalese, allows one, when viewing an entity, to infer some of the properties one cannot directly observe, using the properties one can observe. If Flopsy has long furry ears, he is a rabbit. If he is a rabbit, he might scurry into a burrow and quickly make more rabbits. Moreover, it pays to give objects several labels in mentalese, designating different-sized categories like cottontail rabbit, rabbit, mammal, animal, and living thing. There is a trade-off involved in choosing one category over another. It takes less effort to determine that Peter Cottontail is an animal than that he is a cottontail. For example, an animal-like motion will suffice for us to recognize that he is an animal, leaving it open whether or not he is a cottontail. But we can predict more new things about Peter if we know he is a cottontail than if we merely know he is an animal. If he is a cottontail, he likes carrots and inhabits open country or woodland clearings. If he is merely an animal, he could eat anything and live anywhere, for all one knows. The middle-sized or basic-level category rabbit represents a compromise between how easy it is to label something and how much good the label does you. Finally, why separate the rabbit from the scurry? Presumably because there are predictable consequences of rabbithood that cut across whether it is scurrying, eating, or sleeping. Make a loud sound, and in all cases it will be down a hole, lickety-split. The consequences of making a loud noise in the presence of lionhood, whether eating or sleeping, are predictably different. And that is a difference that makes a difference. Likewise, scurrying has certain consequences regardless of who is doing it. Whether it be rabbit or lion, a scurrier does not remain in the same place for long. With sleeping, a silent approach will generally work to keep a sleeper, rabbit or lion, motionless. Therefore, a powerful prognosticator should have separate sets of mental labels for kinds of objects and kinds of actions. That way, it does not have to learn separately what happens when a rabbit scurries, what happens when a lion scurries, what happens when a rabbit sleeps, what happens when a lion sleeps, what happens when a gazelle scurries, what happens when a gazelle sleeps, and on and on. Knowing about rabbits and lions and gazelles in general, and scurrying and sleeping in general, will suffice. With M objects and N actions, a knower needn't go through M times N learning experiences. It can get away with M plus N of them. So even a wordless thinker does well to chop continuously flowing experience into things, kinds of things, and actions, not to mention places, paths, events, states, kinds of stuff, properties, and other types of concepts. Indeed, experimental studies of baby cognition have shown that infants have the concept of an object before they learn any words for objects, just as we would expect. Well before their first birthday, when first words appear, babies seem to keep track of the bits of stuff that we would call objects. They show surprise if the parts of an object suddenly go their own ways, or if the object magically appears or disappears, passes through another solid object, or hovers in the air without visible means of support. Attaching words to these concepts, of course, allows one to share one's hard-won discoveries and insights about the world with the less experienced or the less observant. Figuring out which word to attach to which concept is the Gavagai problem. And if infants start out with concepts corresponding to the kinds of meanings that languages use, the problem is partly solved. Laboratory studies confirm that young children assume that certain kinds of concepts get certain types of words, and other kinds of concepts cannot be the meaning of a word at all. The developmental psychologists Ellen Markman and Jean Hutchinson gave 2- and 3-year-old children a set of pictures, and for each picture asked them to find another one that is the same as this. Children are intrigued by objects that interact, and when faced with these instructions, they tend to select pictures that make groups of role players, like a blue jay and a nest, or a dog and a bone. But when Markman and Hutchinson told them to find another Dax that is the same as this Dax, the children's criterion shifted. A word must label a kind of thing, they seemed to be reasoning, so they put together a bird with another type of bird, a dog with another type of dog. For a child, a Dax simply cannot mean a dog or its bone, interesting though the combination may be. Of course, more than one word can be applied to a thing. Peter Cottontail is not only a rabbit, but an animal and a cottontail. Children have a bias to interpret nouns as middle-level kinds of objects, like a rabbit, but they also must overcome that bias to learn other types of words, like animal. Children seem to manage this by being in sync with a striking feature of language. Though most common words have many meanings, few meanings have more than one word. That is, homonyms are plentiful, synonyms rare. Virtually all supposed synonyms have some difference in meaning, however small. For example, skinny and slim differ in their connotation of desirability. Policeman and cop differ in formality. No one really knows why languages are so stingy with words and profligate with meanings, but children seem to expect it. Or perhaps it is this expectation that causes it, and that helps them further with the gavagai problem. If a child already knows a word for a kind of thing, then when another word is used for it, he or she does not take the easy but wrong way and treat it as a synonym. Instead, the child tries out some other possible concept. For example, Martman found that if you show a child a pair of pewter tongs and call it Biff, the child interprets Biff as meaning tongs in general, showing the usual bias for middle-level objects, so when asked for more Biffs, the child picks out a pair of plastic tongs. But if you show the child a pewter cup and call it Biff, the child does not interpret Biff as meaning cup because most children already know a word that means cup, namely cup. Loathing synonyms, the children guess that Biff must mean something else, and the stuff the cup is made of is the next most readily available concept. When asked for more Biffs, the child chooses a pewter spoon or pewter tongs. Many other ingenious studies have shown how children home in on the correct meanings for different kinds of words. Once children know some syntax, they can use it to sort out different kinds of meaning. For example, the psychologist Roger Brown showed children a picture of hands kneading a mass of little squares in a bowl. If he asked them, "Can you see any sibbing?" the children pointed to the hands. If instead he asked them, "Can you see a sib?" they pointed to the bowl. And if he asked, "Can you see any sib?" they point to the stuff inside the bowl. Other experiments have uncovered great sophistication in children's understanding of how classes of words fit into sentence structures and how they relate to concepts and kinds. So, what's in a name? The answer, we have seen, is a great deal. In the sense of a morphological product, a name is an intricate structure, elegantly assembled by layers of rules and lawful even at its quirkiest. And in the sense of a listeme, a name is a pure symbol, part of a cast of thousands, rapidly acquired because of a harmony between the mind of the child, the mind of the adult, and the texture of reality. Chapter 6. The Sounds of Silence. When I was a student, I worked in a laboratory at McGill University that studied auditory perception. Using a computer, I would synthesize trains of overlapping tones and determine whether they sounded like one rich sound or two pure ones. One Monday morning, I had an odd experience. The tones suddenly turned into a chorus of screaming munchkins. Like this. Beep, boop, boop. Beep, boop, boop. Beep, boop, boop. Humpty, dumpty, humpty, dumpty, humpty, dumpty. Beep, boop, boop. Beep, boop, boop. Humpty, dumpty, humpty, dumpty, humpty, humpty, dumpty, dumpty. Beep, boop, boop. Beep, boop, boop. Beep, boop, boop. Humpty, dumpty, beep, boop, boop. Humpty, 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 dumpty, beep, boop, boop. I checked the oscilloscope. Two streams of tones, as programmed. The effect had to be perceptual. With a bit of effort, I could go back and forth, hearing the sound as either beeps or munchkins. When a fellow student entered, I recounted my discovery, mentioning that I couldn't wait to tell Professor Bregman, who directed the laboratory. She offered some advice. Don't tell anyone, except perhaps Professor Poser, who directed the psychopathology program. Years later, I discovered what I had discovered. The psychologists Robert Remes, David Pizzoni, and their colleagues braver men than I am, published an article in Science on sine wave speech. They synthesized three simultaneous wavering tones. Physically, the sound was nothing at all like speech, but the tones followed the same contours as the bands of energy in the sentence, "Where were you a year ago?" Volunteers described what they heard as science fiction sounds or computer bleeps. A second group of volunteers was told that the sounds had been generated by a bad speech synthesizer. They were able to make out many of the words, and a quarter of them could write down the sentence perfectly. The brain can hear speech content in sounds that have only the remotest resemblance to speech. Indeed, sine wave speech is how minor birds fool us. They have a valve on each bronchial tube and can control them independently, producing two wavering tones, which we hear as speech. Our brains can flip between hearing something as a bleep and hearing it as a word, because phonetic perception is like a sixth sense. When we listen to speech, the actual sounds go in one ear and out the other. What we perceive is language. Our experience of words and syllables, of the B-ness of B and the E-ness of E, is as separable from our experience of pitch and loudness as lyrics are from a score. Sometimes, as in sine wave speech, the senses of hearing and phonetics compete over which gets to interpret a sound, and our perception jumps back and forth. Sometimes the two senses simultaneously interpret a single sound. If one takes a tape recording of da, electronically removes the initial chirp-like portion that distinguishes the da from ga and ka, and plays the chirp to one ear and the residue to the other, what people hear is a chirp in one ear and da in the other. A single clip of sound is perceived simultaneously as D-ness and a chirp. And sometimes phonetic perception can transcend the auditory channel. If you watch an English subtitled movie in a language you know poorly, after a few minutes you may feel as if you are actually understanding the speech. In the laboratory, researchers can dub a speech sound like ga onto a close-up video of a mouth articulating va, ba, tha, or da. Viewers literally hear a consonant like the one they see the mouth making, an astonishing illusion with the pleasing name McGurk effect, after one of its discoverers. Actually, one does not need electronic wizardry to create a speech illusion. All speech is an illusion. We hear speech as a string of separate words, but unlike the tree falling in the forest with no one to hear it, a word boundary with no one to hear it has no sound. In the speech sound wave, one word runs into the next seamlessly. There are no little silences between spoken words the way there are white spaces between written words. We simply hallucinate word boundaries when we reach the edge of a stretch of sound that matches some entry in our mental dictionary. This becomes apparent when we listen to speech in a foreign language. It is impossible to tell where one word ends and the next begins. The seamlessness of speech is also apparent in oronyms, strings of sound that can be carved into words in two different ways. The good can decay many ways. The good candy came anyways. The stuff he knows can lead to problems. The stuff he knows can lead to problems. Some others I've seen. Some mothers I've seen. Oronyms are often used in songs and nursery rhymes. I scream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream. Mares eat oats and does eat oats and little lambs eat ivy. A kid'll eat ivy too, wouldn't you? Fuzzy Wuzzy was a bear. Fuzzy Wuzzy had no hair. Fuzzy Wuzzy wasn't Fuzzy Wuzzy. In fir tar is, in oak none is, in mud eel is, in clay none is, goats eat ivy, mares eat oats. And some are discovered inadvertently by teachers reading their students' term papers and homework assignments. Jose, can you see by the dawn's early light? Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? It's a doggy dog world. Dog eat dog. Eugene O'Neill won a Pulitzer Prize. Pulitzer Prize. My mother comes from Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania. He was in Notre Republic. Notre Republic. They played the Bohemian Rhapsody. Bohemian Rhapsody. Even the sequence of sounds we think we hear within a word is an illusion. If you were to cut up a tape of someone's saying cat, you would not get pieces that sounded like K, A, and T, the units called phonemes that correspond roughly to the letters of the alphabet. And if you spliced the pieces together in the reverse order, they would be unintelligible. Not tack. As we shall see, information about each component of a word is smeared over the entire word. Speech perception is another one of the biological miracles making up the language instinct. There are obvious advantages to using the mouth and ear as a channel of communication, and we do not find any hearing community opting for sign language, though it is just as expressive. Speech does not require good lighting, face-to-face contact, or monopolizing the hands and eyes, and it can be shouted over long distances or whispered to conceal the message. But to take advantage of the medium of sound, speech has to overcome the problem that the ear is a narrow informational bottleneck. When engineers first tried to develop reading mechanics for the blind in the 1940s, they devised a set of noises that corresponded to the letters of the alphabet. Even with heroic training, people could not recognize the sounds at a rate faster than good Morse code operators, about 3 units a second. Real speech, somehow, is perceived an order of magnitude faster, 10 to 15 phonemes per second for casual speech, 20 to 30 per second for the man in the late-night Vegematic ads, and as many as 40 to 50 per second for artificially sped-up speech. Given how the human auditory system works, this is almost unbelievable. When a sound like a click is repeated at a rate of 20 times a second or faster, we no longer hear it as a sequence of separate sounds, but as a low buzz. If we can hear 45 phonemes per second, the phonemes cannot possibly be consecutive bits of sound. Each moment of sound must have several phonemes packed into it that our brains somehow unpack. As a result, speech is by far the fastest way of getting information into the head through the ear. No human-made system can match a human in decoding speech. It is not for lack of need or trying. A speech recognizer would be a boon to quadriplegics and other disabled people, to professionals who have to get information into a computer while their eyes or hands are busy, to people who never learned to type, to users of telephone services, and to the growing number of typists who are victims of repetitive motion syndromes. So it is not surprising that engineers have been working for more than 40 years to get computers to recognize the spoken word. The engineers have been frustrated by a trade-off. If a system has to be able to listen to many different people, it can recognize only a tiny number of words. For example, telephone companies are beginning to install directory assistance systems that can recognize anyone saying the word yes, or, in the more advanced systems, the 10 English digits, which, fortunately for the engineers, have very different sounds. But if a system has to recognize a large number of words, it has to be trained to the voice of a single speaker. No system today can duplicate a person's ability to recognize both many words and many speakers. Perhaps the state of the art is a system called Dragon Dictate, which runs on a personal computer and can recognize 30,000 words. But it has severe limitations. It has to be trained extensively on the voice of the user. You have to talk to it like this, with quarter-second pauses between the words. So it operates at about 1/5 the rate of ordinary speech. If you have to use a word that is not in its dictionary, like a name, you have to spell it out using the Alpha Bravo Charlie alphabet. And the program still garbles words about 15% of the time, more than once per sentence. It is an impressive product, but no match for even a mediocre stenographer. The physical and neural machinery of speech is a solution to two problems in the design of the human communication system. A person might know 60,000 words, but a person's mouth cannot make 60,000 different noises, at least not ones that the ear can easily discriminate. So language has exploited the principle of the discrete combinatorial system again. Sentences and phrases are built out of words, words are built out of morphemes, and morphemes, in turn, are built out of phonemes. Unlike words and morphemes, though, phonemes do not contribute bits of meaning to the whole. The meaning of dog is not predictable from the meaning of de, the meaning of aw, the meaning of g, and their order. Phonemes are a different kind of linguistic object. They connect outward to speech, not inward to mentalese. A phoneme corresponds to an act of making a sound. A division into independent discrete combinatorial systems, one combining meaningless sounds into meaningful morphemes, the others combining meaningful morphemes into meaningful words, phrases, and sentences, is a fundamental design feature of human language, which the linguist Charles Hockett has called duality of patterning. But the phonological module of the language instinct has to do more than spell out the morphemes. The rules of language are discrete combinatorial systems. Phonemes snap cleanly into morphemes, morphemes into words, words into phrases. They do not blend or melt or coalesce. Dog bites man differs from man bites dog, and believing in God is different from believing in dog. But to get these structures out of one head and into another, they must be converted to audible signals. The audible signals people can produce are not a series of crisp beeps like on a touch-tone phone. Speech is a river of breath, bent into hisses and hums by the soft flesh of the mouth and throat. The problems Mother Nature faced are digital to analog conversion when the talker encodes strings of discrete symbols into a continuous stream of sound, and analog to digital conversation when the listener decodes continuous speech back into discrete symbols. The sounds of language, then, are put together in several steps. A finite inventory of phonemes is sampled and permuted to define words, and the resulting strings of phonemes are then massaged to make them easier to pronounce and understand before they are actually articulated. I will trace out these steps for you and show you how they shape some of our everyday encounters with speech, poetry and song, slips of the ear, accents, speech recognition machines, and crazy English spelling. One way to understand speech sounds is to track a glob of air through the vocal tract into the world, starting in the lungs. When we talk, we depart from our usual rhythmic breathing and take in quick breaths of air, then release them steadily, using the muscles of the ribs to counteract the elastic recoil force of the lungs. If we did not, our speech would sound like the pathetic whine of a released balloon. Syntax overrides carbon dioxide. We suppress the delicately tuned feedback loop that controls our breathing rate to regulate oxygen intake, and instead we time our exhalations to the length of the phrase or sentence we intend to utter. This can lead to mild hyperventilation or hypoxia, which is why public speaking is so exhausting and why it is difficult to carry on a conversation with a jogging partner. The air leaves the lungs through the trachea, windpipe, which opens into the larynx, the voice box visible on the outside as the Adam's apple. The larynx is a valve consisting of an opening, the glottis, covered by two flaps of retractable muscular tissue called the vocal folds. They are also called vocal cords because of an early anatomist's error. They are not cords at all. The vocal folds can close off the glottis tightly, sealing the lungs. This is useful when we want to stiffen our upper body, which is a floppy bag of air. Get up from your chair without using your arms, you will feel your larynx tighten. The larynx is also closed off in physiological functions like coughing and defecation. The grunt of the weightlifter or tennis player is a reminder that we use the same organ to seal the lungs and to produce sound. The vocal folds can also be partly stretched over the glottis to produce a buzz as the air rushes past. This happens because the high-pressure air pushes the vocal folds open, at which point they spring back and get sucked together, closing the glottis until air pressure builds up and pushes them open again, starting a new cycle. Breath is thus broken into a series of puffs of air, which we perceive as a buzz, called voicing. You can hear and feel the buzz by making the sounds s, which lacks voicing, and zzz, which has it. The frequency of the vocal folds opening and closing determines the pitch of the voice. By changing the tension and position of the vocal folds, we can control the frequency and hence the pitch. This is most obvious in humming or singing, but we also change pitch continuously over the course of a sentence, a process called intonation. Normal intonation is what makes natural speech sound different from the speech of robots in old science fiction movies and of the Coneheads on Saturday Night Live. Intonation is also controlled in sarcasm, emphasis, and an emotional tone of voice such as anger or cheeriness. In tone languages, like Chinese, rising or falling tones distinguish certain vowels from others. Though voicing creates a sound wave with a dominant frequency of vibration, it is not like a tuning fork or a test of the emergency broadcasting system, a pure tone with that frequency alone. Voicing is a rich, buzzy sound with many harmonics. A male voice is a wave with vibrations not only at 100 cycles per second, CPS, but also at 200 CPS, 300 CPS, 400 CPS, 500 CPS, 600 CPS, 700 CPS, and so on, all the way up to 4,000 CPS and beyond. A female voice has vibrations at 200 CPS, 400 CPS, 600 CPS, and so on. The richness of the sound source is crucial. It is the raw material that the rest of the vocal tract sculpts into vowels and consonants. If, for some reason, we cannot produce a hum from the larynx, any rich source of sound will do. When we whisper, we spread the vocal folds, causing the airstream to break apart chaotically at the edges of the folds and creating a turbulence or noise that sounds like hissing or radio static. A hissing noise is not a neatly repeating wave consisting of a sequence of harmonics, as we find in the periodic sound of a speaking voice, but a jagged, spiky wave consisting of a hodgepodge of constantly changing frequencies. This mixture, though, is all that the rest of the vocal tract needs for intelligible whispering. Some laryngectomy patients are taught esophageal speech, or controlled burping, which provides the necessary noise. Others place a vibrator against their necks. In the 1970s, the guitarist Peter Frampton funneled the amplified sound of his electric guitar through a tube into his mouth, allowing him to articulate his twangings. The effect was good for a couple of hit records before he sank into rock and roll oblivion. The richly vibrating air then runs through a gauntlet of chambers before leaving the head, the throat or pharynx behind the tongue, the mouth region between the tongue and palate, the opening between the lips, and an alternative route to the external world through the nose. Each chamber has a particular length and shape, which affects the sound passing through by the phenomenon called resonance. Sounds of different frequencies have different wavelengths. The distance between the crests of the sound wave. Higher pitches have shorter wavelengths. A sound wave moving down the length of a tube bounces back when it reaches the opening at the other end. If the length of the tube is a certain fraction of the wavelength of the sound, each reflected wave will reinforce the next incoming one. If it is of a different length, they will interfere with one another. This is similar to how you get the best effect pushing a child on a swing if you synchronize each push with the top of the arc. Thus, a tube of a particular length amplifies some sound frequencies and filters out others. You can hear the effect when you fill a bottle. The noise of the sloshing water gets filtered by the chamber of air between the surface and the opening. The more water, the smaller the chamber. the higher the resonant frequency of the chamber, and the tinnier the gurgle. What we hear as different vowels are the different combinations of amplifications and filtering of the sound coming up from the larynx. These combinations are produced by moving 5 speech organs around in the mouth to change the shapes and lengths of the resonant cavities that the sound passes through. For example, E is defined by 2 resonances, one from 200 to 350 CPS, produced mainly by the throat cavity, and the other from 2,100 to 3,000 CPS, produced mainly by the mouth cavity. The range of frequencies that a chamber filters is independent of the particular mixture of frequencies that enters it, so we can hear an E as an E, whether it is spoken, whispered, sung high, sung low, burped, or twanged. The tongue is the most important of the speech organs, making language truly the gift of tongues. Actually, the tongue is 3 organs in one: the hump or body, the tip, and the root, the muscles that anchor it to the jaw. Pronounce the vowels in bet and but repeatedly. You should feel the body of your tongue moving forwards and backwards. If you put a finger between your teeth, you can feel it with the finger. When your tongue is in the front of your mouth, it lengthens the air chamber behind it in your throat and shortens the one in front of it in your mouth, altering one of the resonances. For the bet vowel, the mouth amplifies sounds near 600 and 1800 CPS. For the but vowel, it amplifies sounds near 600 and 1200. Now, pronounce the vowels in beat and bat alternately. The body of your tongue will jump up and down at right angles to the bet-butt motion. You can even feel your jaw move to help it. This, too, alters the shapes of the throat and mouth chambers, and hence their resonances. The brain interprets the different patterns of amplification and filtering as different vowels. The link between the postures of the tongue and the vowels it sculpts gives rise to a quaint curiosity of English and many other languages called phonetic symbolism. When the tongue is high and at the front of the mouth, it makes a small resonant cavity there that amplifies some higher frequencies, and the resulting vowels like E and I, as in bit, remind people of little things. When the tongue is low and to the back, it makes a large resonant cavity that amplifies some lower frequencies, and the resulting vowels like ah in father and o in core and in cot remind people of large things. Thus, mice are teeny and squeak, but elephants are humongous and roar. Audio speakers have small tweeters for the high sounds and large woofers for the low ones. English speakers correctly guess that in Chinese, qing means light and cheng means heavy. In control studies with large numbers of foreign words, the hit rate is statistically above chance, though just barely. When I questioned our local computer wizard about what she meant when she said that she was going to frob my workstation, she gave me this tutorial on hackerese. When you get a brand new graphic equalizer for your stereo and aimlessly slide the knobs up and down to hear the effects, that is frobbing. When you move the knobs by medium-sized amounts to get the sound to your general liking, that is twiddling. When you make the final small adjustments to get it perfect, that is tweaking. The ob, id, and eek sounds perfectly follow the large to small continuum of phonetic symbolism. And at the risk of sounding like Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes, have you ever wondered why we say fiddle-faddle and not faddle-fiddle? Why is it ping-pong and pitter-patter rather than pong-ping and patter-pitter? Why dribs and drabs rather than vice versa? Why can't a kitchen be span and spick? Whence riff-raff, mish-mash, flim-flam, chit-chat, tit-for-tat, knick-knack, zig-zag, sing-song, ding-dong, king-kong, criss-cross, shilly-shally, see-saw, hee-haw, flip-flop, hippity-hop, tick-tock, tic-tac-toe, eeny-meeny-miny-mo, bric-a-brac, clickety-clack, hickory-dickory-dock, Kit and Caboodle, and Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo. The answer is that the vowels for which the tongue is high and in the front always come before the vowels for which the tongue is low and in the back. No one knows why they are aligned in this order, but it seems to be a kind of syllogism from two other oddities. The first is that words that connote me here now tend to have higher and fronter vowels than verbs that connote distance from me. Me versus you, here versus there, this versus that. The second is that words that connote me here now tend to come before words that connote literal or metaphorical distance from me, or a prototypical generic speaker. Here and there, not there and here, this and that, now and then, father and son, man and machine, friend or foe, the Harvard-Yale game, among Harvard students, the Yale-Harvard game, among Yalees, Serbo-Croatian, among Serbs, Croat-Serbian, among Croats. The syllogism seems to be me, high front vowel, me first, therefore high front vowel first. It is as if the mind just cannot bring itself to flip a coin in ordering words. If meaning does not determine the order, sound is brought to bear, and the rationale is based on how the tongue produces the vowels. Let's look at the other speech organs. Pay attention to your lips when you alternate between the vowels in boot and book. For boot, you round the lips and protrude them. This adds an air chamber with its own resonances to the front of the vocal tract, amplifying and filtering other sets of frequencies and thus defining other vowel contrasts. Because of the acoustic effects of the lips, when we talk to a happy person over the phone, we can literally hear the smile. Remember your grade school teacher telling you that the vowel sounds in bat, bet, bit, bottle, and butt were short, and the vowel sounds in bait, beat, bite, boat, and boot were long, and you didn't know what she was talking about? Well, forget it. Her information is 500 years out of date. Older stages of English differentiated words by whether their vowels were pronounced quickly or were drawn out, a bit like the modern distinction between bad, meaning bad, and bad, meaning good. But in the 15th century, English pronunciation underwent a convulsion called the Great Vowel Shift. The vowels that had simply been pronounced longer now became tense by advancing the tongue root. The muscles attaching the tongue to the jaw, the tongue becomes tense and humped rather than lax and flat, and the hump narrows the air chamber in the mouth above it, changing the resonances. Also, some tense vowels in modern English, like in bite and brow, are diphthongs, two vowels pronounced in quick succession as if they were one, bite, brow. You can hear the effects of the fifth speech organ by drawing out the vowel in Sam and Sat, postponing the final consonant indefinitely. In most dialects of English, the vowels will be different. The vowel in Sam will have a twangy nasal sound. That is because the soft palate or velum, the fleshy flap at the back of the hard palate, is opened, allowing air to flow out through the nose as well as through the mouth. The nose is another resonant chamber, and when vibrating air flows through it, yet another set of frequencies gets amplified and filtered. English does not differentiate words by whether their vowels are nasal or not, but many languages, like French, Polish, and Portuguese, do. English speakers who open their soft palate even when producing sat are said to have a nasal voice. When you have a cold and your nose is blocked, opening the soft palate makes no difference, and your voice is the opposite of nasal. So far, we have just discussed the vowels, sounds where the air has clear passage from the larynx to the world. When some barrier is put in the way, one gets a consonant. Pronounce s. The tip of your tongue, the sixth speech organ, is brought up almost against the gum ridge, leaving a small opening. When you force a stream of air through the opening, the air breaks apart turbulently, creating noise. Depending on the size of the opening and the length of the resonant cavities in front of it, the noise will have some of its frequencies louder than others, and the peak and range of frequencies define the sound we hear as S. The noise making comes from the friction of moving air, so this kind of sound is called a fricative. When rushing air is squeezed between the tongue and palate, we get sh, between the tongue and teeth, f, and between the lower lip and teeth, f. The body of the tongue or the vocal folds of the larynx can also be positioned to create turbulence, defining the various h sounds in languages like German, Hebrew, and Arabic, Bach, Hanukkah, and so on. Now pronounce a T. The tip of the tongue gets in the way of the airstream, but this time it does not merely impede the flow, it stops it entirely. When the pressure builds up, you release the tip of the tongue, allowing the air to pop out. Flutists use this motion to demarcate musical notes. Other stop consonants can be formed by the lips, p, by the body of the tongue pressed against the palate, k, and by the larynx, in the glottal consonants, in uh-oh. What a listener hears when you produce a stop consonant is the following. First, nothing, as the air is dammed up behind the stoppage. Stop consonants are the sounds of silence. Then a brief burst of noise as the air is released. Its frequency depends on the size of the opening and the resonant cavities in front of it. Finally, a smoothly changing resonance as voicing fades in while the tongue is gliding into the position of whatever vowel comes next. As we shall see, this hop, skip, and jump makes life miserable for speech engineers. Finally, pronounce mmm. Your lips are sealed, just like for p, but this time the air does not back up silently. You can say mmm until you are out of breath. That is because you have also opened your soft palate, allowing all of the air to escape through your nose. The voicing sound is now amplified at the resonant frequencies of the nose and of the part of the mouth behind the blockage. Releasing the lips causes a sliding resonance similar in shape to what we heard for the release in p, except without the silence, noise burst, and fade in. The sound n works similarly to m, except that the blockage is created by the tip of the tongue, the same organ used for d and s. So does the ng in sing, except that the body of the tongue does the job. Why do we say razzle-dazzle instead of dazzle-razzle? Why super-duper, helter-skelter, harum-scarum, hocus-pocus, willy-nilly, holly-golly, roly-poly, holy-moly, herky-jerky, walkie-talkie, namby-pamby, mumbo-jumbo, loosey-goosey, wing-ding, wham-bam, hob-nob, razzmatazz, and rub-a-dub-dub? I thought you'd never ask. Consonants differ in obstruency, the degree to which they impede the flow of air, ranging from merely making it resonate to forcing it noisily past an obstruction to stopping it up altogether. The word beginning with the less obstruent consonant always comes before the word beginning with the more obstruent consonant. Why ask why? Now that you have completed a guided tour up the vocal tract, you can understand how the vast majority of sounds in the world's languages are created and heard. The trick is that a speech sound is not a single gesture by a single organ. Every speech sound is a combination of gestures, each exerting its own pattern of sculpting of the sound wave, all executed more or less simultaneously. That is one of the reasons speech can be so rapid. As you may have noticed, a sound can be nasal or not, and produced by the tongue body, the tongue tip, or the lips, in all six possible combinations. Lips, nasal, soft palate open, mmm, not nasal, soft palate closed, p. Tongue tip, nasal, n, not nasal, t. Tongue body, nasal, not nasal, k. Similarly, voicing combines in all possible ways with the choice of speech organ. Lips,